ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, if you remember, in the previous episode, we discussed the sorrowful event of Imam Khomeini's departure from the mortal world. You heard that the Imam's conditions kept deteriorating and the family, especially his wife, Ms. Saghafi, had prepared herself for the unbelievable event of losing the Imam. Anyhow, the great leader of the Islamic Ummah and the hope of the oppressed and downtrodden all over the world passed away on June 3, 1989. Today, we are going to speak about the glorious farewell and funeral of the Iranian nation for their beloved leader and the announcement of Ayatollah Khamenei as his successor. Stay tuned, please. The announcement of Imam Khomeini's passing away on radio was the most sorrowful and shocking news in the history of Iran. The news plunged the whole country in grief, and everyone rushed to Tehran to bid farewell to the Imam and take part in his funeral. Innumerable masses of people flocked to Jamaran, the residence of Imam Khomeini, to extend their condolences to his family. Lady Saghafi saw off Imam Khomeini's body for some distance and then returned home as she had a serious backache and couldn't move much. Over 10 million people had come to Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery to bid farewell to their beloved leader and bury him in his last abode. But due to the massive participation of people, the burial was delayed for 3 days. Many observers maintain that Imam Khomeini's funeral was the most populated gathering of people ever in history. On the eve of this sad event, many officials gathered at the Imam's house to make decisions on the issues ahead. Many of them were worried about the likely chaos after the passing away of the Imam. Thus, they suggested not broadcasting the news to avoid chaos and imbroglio in the country. But his son, Haj Ahmad, was opposed to the suggestion and stressed that the Imam's family should be honest with people. Therefore, the news was broadcast early next morning and the government announced a week of public holiday, and the heads of 3 branches announced 40 days of public mourning. Imam Khomeini's grave was determined near Behesht-e-Zahra Cemetery, and it was decided to provide a special place at Tehran's Musalla for people to bid farewell to the Imam's pure body. One day later, one of the great sources of emulation, Grand Ayatollah Golpaygani, performed prayer for the Imam's body, and the preparations of burial were made. But the million-strong masses of people failed the officials to handle the ceremony. However, Imam Khomeini was buried on June 5th, plunging the hearts of innumerable masses of lovers in Iran and across the world in profound grief. As it is clear from the videos of the ceremony, the 10 million strong crowd made it impossible for the helicopter carrying the imam's body to land. This was repeated several times till Imam Khomeini's pure body was buried in his last abode. The news of Imam Khomeini's passing away caused many world leaders and officials to express or send messages of condolences to the Iranian officials in nation. Javier Perez de Coya, then UN Secretary General, attended the Iranian mission in New York and extended his condolences to the Iranian people. The imam's passing away also topped the world media. German famous magazine Der Spiegel wrote, "It was only Imam Khomeini who has been admitted even by his enemies to lead a simple and humble life away from worldly desires and luxuries. And there was not the smallest black spot in his life." Radio Moscow said, "A man has departed the world who aroused the Iranian people for struggle against the royal rule and ended 2,500-year kingdom in Iran." With Imam Khomeini's passing away, thousands of mourning ceremonies and gatherings were held all over Iran and many countries, including Sri Lanka, Philippines, Brunei, Malaysia, Indonesia, South Korea, North Korea, China, Japan, Pakistan, India, Afghanistan, Turkey, and almost all Arab countries. Yet, on the other side, it was the enemies of the Iranian nation and the Islamic Revolution who had kept monitoring Iran's events to set the ground for political instability after the imam's departure. The British Queen-sponsored news agency BBC said that the demise of Imam Khomeini has caused a vacuum in the leadership of Iran which can hardly be filled. Voice of America, too, announced with indescribable joy that the demise of Ayatollah will lead to a big instability in Iran, as some predict that the event will likely ignite a civil war in the country. The bloodthirsty terrorist grouplet, MKO, also was making the preparations of a military attack to topple the Islamic Republic. The ousted and escapee president, Abul Hassan Bani Sadr, had also got prepared to return to the country and take power. This wishful thinking was announced on the Zionist-controlled media giant, Associated Press, that Ayatollah Khomeini's death has made it likely for Bani Sadr to soon return to Iran and probably enter the government. All these illusions were ended with the announcement of Ayatollah Khamenei as the successor of Imam Khomeini by the Assembly of Experts a few hours after the burial of Imam Khomeini.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Almost a decade since foreign-backed terrorists in Syria tried to pull the country into chaos, it seems an all-out war against Damascus has failed. That's according to the Secretary General of the Lebanese Resistance Movement, Hezbollah. In a meeting with a large group of influential figures from various Arab and Islamic countries, Said Hassan Nasrallah asserted that many Arab states intend to normalize ties with Syria, but the United States opposes such moves. The Hezbollah chief stressed that Syria's real enemy is the United States, which is going ahead with its war and blockade against Damascus. He argued that Syria has been targeted by a U.S.-led scheme over its rejection to subdue to Washington. He pointed out that Washington's sanction measures against Damascus are failing with the help of the people and Syria's regional allies. In the televised address, Nasrallah hailed Syria for lying in the heart of a powerful axis of resistance, noting that there is confidence that the Arab country would remain at the forefront of the struggle to stand against the West. Nasrallah stressed that Syria's resistance disrupted all equations throughout the entire region. The Hezbollah leader also tied the security of Syria to its neighboring countries, namely Lebanon. He said what happens in Syria and Palestine is reflected directly on the regional countries and has a strong impact on Lebanon in particular. The prominent figure said speaking about the present and future of Syria is like speaking about the present and future of Lebanon. He noted that if Daesh terrorists, who had seized large swathes of land in Syria and Iraq from 2014 to 2017, had remained in the region, it would have affected Lebanon as well. The comments by Hezbollah leader comes as many countries, especially those in the Arab world, are gradually turning towards Syria by normalizing relations with the Arab country. Countries like the United Arab Emirates, Jordan and Oman are among those who have recently restored their relations with Damascus. To add to the list is Tunisia, with President Rais Said announcing plans to fully restore ties with Syria, which was once cut off more than a decade ago. Needless to say that many of those countries join hand in hand with Western nations to sow division in Syria. They also helped the West impose an all-out economic sanction and blockade on Damascus. As Syrian Foreign Minister Faisal Miqdad has numerously said, hegemonic countries had implemented straitjacketed agendas, invested in terrorism, and put economies in a stranglehold with no regard for international law. Miqdad brands what he calls smart sanctions as a form of collective punishment against the Syrian people, who are deprived of access to food, fuel, medications, and other basic necessities. As part of sanctions, the Western world has left no stone unturned to isolate Syria. But to what extent has that scheme been successful? Since the crisis in 2011, Syria has favored dialogue even with the opposition to support national reconciliation and stability. Moreover, Damascus has facilitated the return of millions of refugees who once escaped a foreign-backed militancy from Syria. The Syrian government has also made all its efforts to rebuild the country after large swathes of its land were devastated by terrorist acts. From the military perspective, President Bashar al-Assad, with the support of Iran and Russia, has emerged victorious from the years-long conflict. That could especially be highlighted when the Syrian government managed to retake almost all the territory it lost to foreign-backed terrorists. All in all, what seems to be of high significance is the fact that Syria, with the help of its allies, is managing to stand firm against the West's threats. From partitioning the Arab country to plundering the country's oil, Syria is doing whatever it can to resist against the West. That's exactly what the Hezbollah leader termed as failure of the West and its war on Damascus.
Trilateral meetings in progress in the capital, Beijing. The participants: Saudi Arabia's National Security Advisor, Mossad bin Mohammed al-Aban; Iran's Secretary of the Supreme National Security Council, Ali Shamkhani; and Wang Yi, Director, Office of Foreign Affairs Commission, the Communist Party of China Central Committee. Then came the announcement. After 7 years, Iran and Saudi Arabia have resumed diplomatic ties. Meanwhile, Ali Shamkhani expressed willingness to continue constructive dialogue, fully implement their consensus, and enhance good neighborliness to jointly safeguard regional security.
At the end of the talks, we reached a decision to start a new chapter after 7 years of severed relations between the Islamic Republic of Iran and Saudi Arabia. While considering the interests of the two countries, the security and well-being of the region, and preventing undue intervention from extra-regional forces, particularly from the West, and constant mischief by the Zionist regime in the region. We hope that this new chapter will compensate for the stagnation of relations over these last 7 years and also lead to stability and security in the region, as well as the improvement of the welfare of all its people.
Saudi Arabia was also positive in its assessment of what this deal means. When it comes to the agreement itself, this is what we know. Both have agreed to restore diplomatic relations. This will be followed up by the reopening of embassies and missions within a period not exceeding 2 months. Per protocol, this means the exchange of ambassadors. The two countries agreed to implement the Agreement on Security Cooperation signed on April 17, 2001, and the General Agreement reached on May 27, 1998, aimed at fostering ties in economic, commercial investment, technical, and scientific fields, to name a few. Since the announcement of the restoration of ties between Iran and Saudi Arabia, there's been a tidal wave of responses and reactions. The U.S. President Joe Biden's response was clearly off the mark. He said better relations between Israel and their Arab neighbors are better for everybody. As for Israel, the opposition has been quick to react and has slammed Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. It said the restoration of diplomatic ties between Saudi Arabia and Iran represents a failure of foreign policy by Israel's longest-serving prime minister, Benjamin Netanyahu. There's no doubt, however, that this is seen as a major defeat for the U.S. and its standing, especially when it comes to diplomacy. Mark Dubowitz, the chief executive of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies, has said, "Lose, lose, lose for American interests." This agreement demonstrates the Saudis don't trust Washington to have their back. Iran sees opportunity to peel away U.S. allies to end international isolation. Although this may be a huge diplomatic victory for China, this is also a victory of Iranian policy when it came to Yemen and Saudi Arabia itself. Let's not forget, this was a face-saving deal for the Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, since his Yemen policy was defeated due to the Ansarullah movement's dominance in Yemen. Saudi Arabia was also defeated in Syria when it backed Daesh terrorists with the help of his allies, like the U.S. Other issues leading to the severance of diplomatic ties included how Saudi Arabia executed prominent Shiite cleric Sheikh Nimr al-Nimr. Saudi Arabia was also responsible when it led Persian Gulf Arab monarchies to blacklist the Lebanese resistance group Hezbollah as a terrorist organization. Saudi's past behavior shows that it cannot be a trustworthy partner until certain actions are taken when it comes to issues like Yemen, Palestine, and Syria, where it has played destructive roles. It remains to be seen whether this agreement between Saudi Arabia and Iran to ensure the security of West Asia would translate into a decrease of the U.S. presence in the region to its eventual withdrawal completely.
France has been hit by yet another wave of mass strikes and protests. The row is about President Emmanuel Macron's controversial pension reforms. An estimated 1.28 million people have participated in the nationwide strike. The demonstrations were some of the biggest in decades. The nationwide strike have disrupted train services, shut schools, and halted fuel deliveries. Unions have stepped up their campaign to force a U-turn on a deeply unpopular policy. Workers from different sectors have walked out of their jobs and held demonstrations in Paris and other cities. Refineries have stopped fuel deliveries, most trains have come to a halt, and power production has decreased during the industrial action. Some scuffles have broken out on the sidelines, with some people throwing projectiles at police who responded with tear gas. Unions have threatened to freeze up the economy with work stoppages. Some unions have called for open-ended strikes in sectors from refineries and oil depots to electricity and gas facilities. This is the sixth time since the start of the year that unions called a nationwide day of strikes and demonstrations. The disruption is expected to be greater and last longer as rail unions call for rolling, open-ended strikes. This could affect all national trains as well as international routes. Trains to Germany and Spain came to a halt, and those to and from the United Kingdom and Belgium were reduced by a third. Some students have also blockaded faculties, and some schools closed as teachers staged a one-day strike.
I don't want to work until I'm 64. I say to myself, enough already. For the moment, there are only promises made, and we don't know when it's going to end. So it's better to fight now than to lose our gains. That's it.
People are fed up. People are exhausted. People see around them that there are plenty of colleagues who don't even make it to the current legal retirement age. So how can we expect them to make it to 64? And then, for us, it's 64. But for the years to come and our children, what age will it be? 66? I think the government hasn't taken everything into account.
The strikes and industrial actions are about President Emmanuel Macron's unpopular pension reforms. His government is planning to raise the retirement age from 62 to 64 and increase the number of years of work required to claim a full pension. The change will be gradual, increasing by 3 months per year from September until 2030. From 2027, workers will have to make social security contributions over 43 years rather than 42 in order to get full pensions. The government says the reforms would boost the employment rate among 60 to 64-year-olds. In France, the employment rate in this age category is just 33% compared with 61% in Germany and 69% in Sweden.
Precisely, it is the most precarious people who are going to suffer the most from the reform and who are going to serve two more years. It is scandalous. Mrs. Born has never been a cleaning lady. She has never been a social worker for handicapped kids. She has never done work where you have to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning to go to work with cut-off hours, to work on Saturday nights, on Sundays. She does not know at all. She doesn't know what the people and the population go through. So yes, it is scandalous.
Macron has vowed to go ahead with the bill. The reforms were at the heart of the President Emmanuel Macron's re-election campaign last year, but are proving deeply unpopular. His cabinet says the changes are essential to prevent the pension system from falling into deficit and younger people carrying the burden. Macron's centralist alliance has the most seats in the National Assembly but lost its majority in legislative elections last year. Therefore, it needs to count on the support from the right to be able to pass the bill. Another option for the government would be to use a special constitutional power to force the bill through without a vote. This is a risky choice because such a decision would be highly unpopular.
Since the war in Syria began in early 2011, Western nations and the regional allies have left no stones unturned to topple the Syrian government. These efforts were led by the U.S., which coordinated the efforts of the Western and Arab nations against Damascus. But the U.S. soon began to dispatch its own soldiers and military hardware to the war-stricken nation. The U.S. claimed that the troops sent to Syria were tasked with fighting Daesh terrorists and helped the so-called moderate armed opponents of President Bashar al-Assad. Daesh terrorists were defeated mainly due to the efforts of the resistance front, and U.S.-backed efforts to topple the government in Damascus largely failed. But the U.S. still continues to keep hundreds of its troops in northeast Syria. Over the years, U.S. forces have been involved with the theft of Syria's natural resources, including its oil.
Very importantly, as you know, we have the oil, and we left soldiers for the oil because we take the oil and we're working on that, and we have it very nicely secured.
We've kept the oil. We stayed back and kept the oil. Other people can patrol the border of Syria, frankly, and Turkey, let them. They've been fighting for 1,000 years. let them do the border. We don't want to do that. We want to bring our soldiers home. But we did leave soldiers because we're keeping the oil. I like oil. We're keeping the oil.
The U.S. regime is also using its troops in that region to coordinate anti-Damascus efforts with the Kurdish militants. By backing the Kurdish-led SDF in eastern Syria, the U.S. controls about a third of the country, an area where most of Syria's oil fields are located. Just recently, the U.S. Chairman of the Joint Chief of Staff, Mark Milley, visited Syria, marking his first visit to the country as a top U.S. general. Damascus condemned the visit as, quote, illegal and a flagrant violation of Syria's sovereignty. Calls are now growing to end the illegal presence in Syria. A resolution was circulated in the U.S. House of Representatives, which called for the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Syria. The resolution was submitted by Republican Matt Gaetz and was supported by other Republican lawmakers. The resolution was ultimately defeated by Congress, but it could be a signal of growing uneasiness with the presence of U.S. troops in the war-torn nation.
I do not believe that what stands between a caliphate and not a caliphate are the 900 Americans who have been sent to this hellscape with no definition of victory, with no clear objective, and purely existing as a vestige to the regime change, failed foreign policies of multiple former presidents.
Syria is not the only country in West Asia that hosts unwanted U.S. troops. Syria's neighbor Iraq is also home to hundreds of U.S. soldiers. Earlier this week, the Pentagon chief made an unannounced visit to Iraq, where he announced Washington's intent to maintain its military presence there. Austin is the most senior official in the Biden administration to visit the country. The presence of U.S. troops in Iraq began in 2003, after Washington invaded the country. March 19, 2003, the U.S. and Britain invaded Iraq in blatant violation of international law under the pretext of finding weapons of mass destruction. But no such weapons were ever discovered in Iraq.
The objective is to compel Iraq to destroy its illegal weapons of mass destruction and its programs to develop and produce missiles and more of those weapons. Saddam is dangerous. The world would be a better place without him. But the reason he poses a growing danger to the United States and its allies is that he possesses chemical and biological weapons and is seeking nuclear weapons. And unlike my colleague from West Virginia and Maryland, I do not believe this is a rush to war. I believe it's a march to peace and security.
Indeed, the facts and Iraq's behavior show that Saddam Hussein and his regime are concealing their efforts to produce more weapons of mass destruction.
At this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger.
According to the California-based investigative organization Project Censored, more than 1 million Iraqis were killed as a result of the U.S.-led invasion and occupation of the country. The U.S. withdrew its forces in 2011, claiming that it had ended its combat mission in Iraq. But hundreds of U.S. troops still remain inside the Arab country on what Washington describes as an advisory mission. Following the U.S. assassination of Iran's anti-terror commander, General Qasem Soleimani, and his Iraqi trench mate, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, Iraqi parliament passed a resolution that called for the withdrawal of all U.S. troops from the country. However, Washington kept its force inside the country in defiance of a resolution. The U.S. military declared the end of its combat mission in Iraq in December 2021, but it still maintains a number of troops there under the guise of playing an advisory and training role.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
Tourism. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, as a reminder, in the previous episode, we briefly talked about Turkmens and their foods. Today, we are going to touch upon Aliabad Katul in Golestan province and make you familiar with some of the foods in this region. This is the last episode in which we speak about the foods of Golestan province. Next time, we will go to another province. Stay tuned, please. Aliabad Katul is located in the east of Golestan province. It has a very beautiful nature. Kabud Wal waterfall is located in the forests of this region. This waterfall is the highest mossy waterfall in the world. Mention can be made of Yew Forest as another tourist attraction of the region. This is in fact one of the main reserves of yew woods in the world. Katul ethnicity is among original Iranian people who have lived here since old times. It used to be one of the seven regions of the eastern Tabaristan. Tabaristan was the name of a part of the area between Alborz Mountains and the Caspian Sea. Katul people have their special traditions and customs. In traditional ceremonies, women wear red shirt, a wrinkled skirt, a cap, and a scarf, all of which have been adorned beautifully. Men wear white shirts, black vests, and trousers with a round black cap and special shoes. Katul people have their special kind of music, which is based on couplets and is read out at gatherings and parties in a very simple way. People of Aliabad Katul make tasty foods from forest fruits such as hawthorn, barberry, common medlar, and so on. Common medlar is easily found in the region. This fruit is native to Iran and South Asia. It has been transferred by Romans to the littoral countries of the Black Sea and Europe. The Greek geographer Strabo has mentioned the fruit in the fourth chapter of his book, Geographica. Medlar is very rich in antioxidants, hence its high value in protecting the body against cancer. It is believed that the fruit is also helpful in treatment of cataract and diabetes. Research has revealed that medlar is effective in prevention of Alzheimer and other nervous ailments too. Besides the fruit, the leaves of this plant are also used to reduce chest pain and coughing. Moreover, ursolic acid in the leaf of medlar is used to control AIDS. Medlar is also useful in normalization of cholesterol and burning fat. People of Aliabad Katul use medlar to make various kinds of pickles, paste, and cool drinks. Dear listeners, people of Aliabad Katul enjoy a variety of foods. Among these foods, one can mention torshu, a kind of sour broth, torshi polo, a kind of sour rice, mash polo, veg and rice, and solof khoresh, a kind of a stew made from a local plant. Solof is from the spinach family and grows abundantly in this region. The leaves, roots, and seeds of this plant are used for curing diseases. Solof contains oxalic acid. It has low amount of calorie and high amount of water. The leaves are used in foods and medicines, but the roots are mainly used as medicine. People of the region prepare a stew from this vegetable called solof horesh. To make this food, you will need a kilogram of solof, a glass of beans, a glass of veg, a few garlic cloves, 4 glasses of water, pomegranate paste, oil, salt, and pepper, as much as needed. Now, the recipe for making this food. Before making the stew, cook the vegetable in boiled water for 2 minutes. Also, cook the legumes beforehand so that it takes less time to prepare the stew. Well, in a separate dish, fry the garlic cloves mildly and then add veg and beans and fry them mildly. Now, add solof vegetable and fry it well with pomegranate paste. Then add salt and pepper and finally pour 4 glasses of water and leave it to cook completely. Since the vegetable in this stew is from spinach family, it is full of iron and also a variety of vitamins. That marks the end of this episode and our tour of Golestan province and familiarity with some of its delicious foods. Next time, we will go to Gilan province, which is very rich in edibles and foods. God bless you.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is a part of the speech delivered by Imam Khamenei, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, on October 3rd, 2022, during the joint graduation ceremony for the cadets studying in the academies of the Islamic Republic of Iran's armed forces. The ceremony was held in Imam Hassan al-Mushtaba alayhi salam University of Office and Police Training. These riots had been planned. If the incident with the young girl had not taken place, they have found another excuse to create insecurity and riots in the country in the beginning of the month of May, September, this year. It is clearly the work of none other than the spy agencies and malicious foreign politicians. They can see the movement toward progress which is accelerating in the country. This is the fact. In all areas, an accelerating movement can be seen and felt. They can see and feel this as well. They do not want this to happen. They can see that factories that have been almost shut down have started operating again. They can see knowledge-based companies working. They can see advanced protection day by day in some sectors. They can see things being done that can neutralize the effects of the sanctions, which is currently the enemy's only weapon. They can see these things.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
In order to stop this progress, they are making plans. They have plans for universities and plans for the streets. They have made plans. They have designed plans to close down the universities, for the youth to be preoccupied, for the state officials to have new things to deal with and to create issues in the northwest and southeast of the country. These are all preoccupying. These are all schemes being made and carried out to stall the country's progressive movement. But they are mistaken about both the northwest and the southeast. I've lived with the Baluch people. They are some of the most loyal ethnicities of the Islamic Revolution and the Islamic Republic. The Kurds are one of the most advanced Iranian ethnicities. They care about their homeland. They care about Islam, and they care about the Islamic system. The enemy's schemes will not work, but they work on them anyway. These things show the enemy's true intentions. This is the enemy that claims in its diplomatic statements that they do not want to attack Iran. They do not want to change the system of the Islamic Republic. They are not our enemies, and they are with the people of Iran. The inner reality of that enemy is what we are seeing. The inner reality of this enemy is conspiracy, creating riots, disrupting the safety of the country, and exciting those who can be easily excited to go into the streets. This is the enemy's inner reality.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
An analyst known for accurately predicting past crises has claimed that a recent spate of failures in the US portends economic trouble and bank and cryptocurrency failures ahead. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. RT noted, Stephanie Pombey, the U.S. economist known for her predictions of America's early 2000s housing bubble and the 2008 global financial collapse, has sounded the alarm on a recent spate of bank and cryptocurrency failures that could be just the beginning of another cascading crisis in the U.S. What we are facing right now is really serious, Pombey, founder of economic research firm Macro Maven, said recently in a Fox News interview, adding, "We are on the brink of a 2008-style financial crisis." She made her assessment in the wake of the recent shutdown of Silicon Valley Bank, SVB, by federal regulators, the second largest failure in U.S. banking history. SVB's collapse came on the heels of this week's closure of cryptocurrency lender Silvergate Bank, as well as the bankruptcies last fall of crypto firms FTX, BlockFi, and Three Arrows Capital. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen issued a statement recently declaring that the U.S. banking system remains resilient and regulators have effective tools to address this type of event. Pomboy was unconvinced, mocking Yellen for an absolutely insane focus on diversity, equity, and inclusion at a time when rapid increases in interest rates by the U.S. Federal Reserve are exposing the fragility of the nation's debt-laden financial system. The economy said, look, you don't raise rates in record fashion on an economy touting record leverage at maximum speculation and expect no consequences. Adding, this was clearly going to happen, and now we are seeing the weak links in the chain break. The areas where speculation was most rampant and most egregious are clearly coming down. She added that years of excessive risk-taking are coming back to bite them hard and predicted that the situation will devolve very rapidly. Republican presidential candidate Vivek Ramaswamy argued that just as in the 2008 financial crisis, which stemmed partly from the federal government's push to ease credit standards in low-income communities, SVB's failure may have been fueled by politics. In SVB's case, a focus on so-called sustainable finance, or ESG, may have contributed to bad lending decisions, he said, adding, when we don't learn lessons, history repeats itself. Billionaire hedge fund manager Bill Ackman warned that SVB's failure may trigger runs on other troubled banks, causing a 2008-like chain reaction as the dominoes continue to fall. Meanwhile, New York Times noted the U.S. economy could quickly shed a million jobs and fall into recession if lawmakers fail to raise the nation's borrowing limit before the federal government exhausts its ability to pay its bills on time. The chief economist of Moody's Analytics, Mark Zandi, warned a Senate panel recently. The damage could spiral to 7 million jobs lost and a 2008-style financial crisis in the event of a prolonged breach of the debt limit, in which House Republicans refused for months to join Democrats in voting to raise the cap. Zandi and his colleagues Kristen Riaritis and Bernard Yaros wrote in an analysis prepared for the Senate Banking Committee Subcommittee on Economic Policy. Senator Elizabeth Warren, Democrat of Massachusetts, held the subcommittee hearing on the debt limit and its economic and financial consequences at a moment of fiscal brinksmanship. House Republicans are demanding deep spending cuts from Biden in exchange for voting to raise the debt limit, which caps how much money the government can borrow. That debate is likely to escalate when Biden releases his latest budget proposal. The president is expected to propose reducing America's reliance on borrowed money by raising taxes on high earners and corporations. But he almost certainly will not match the level of spending cuts that will satisfy Republican demands to balance the budget in a decade. The report also warns of a stark economic damage if Biden, in an attempt to avert a default, agrees to those demands. In that scenario, the dramatic spending cuts that would be needed to balance the budget would push the economy into recession in 2024, cost the economy 2.6 million jobs, and effectively destroy a year's worth of economic growth over the next decade, Zandi and his colleagues wrote. They said the only real option is for lawmakers to come to terms and increase the debt limit in a timely way. Any other scenario results in significant economic damage. The economy is very vulnerable, he added, saying, even without the debt limit drama, the recession risks are high. It won't take much to push us in, and this is certainly a lot more than much. Zandi's analyses are frequently cited by the Biden administration in support of its economic policy proposals. In this case, Warren is using the Moody's work to push Biden in a letter sent to the White House this week to resist Republican demands for spending cuts and instead continue insisting on a debt limit increase that is not tied to any changes in fiscal policy. Warren, in an interview, said everyone has been talking up to now about how dangerous it would be to default on the national debt, and that's right. But it would be even more dangerous to give in to the Republican cuts. The president has stood strong, and I urge him to continue to do that. Zandi's projections join a growing list of warnings from forecasters on Wall Street and at Washington think tanks about the consequences of failing to increase the borrowing limit in a timely manner. House Republicans have refused to raise the limit unless Biden agrees to deep but unspecified cuts in federal spending. They say the nation's current levels of debt, accumulated in bipartisan fashion over two decades of the federal government spending more money than it receives in tax revenue, pose a current and future threat to economic growth. The government hit its statutory $31.4 trillion debt limit in January. The Treasury Department is employing what is essentially accounting maneuvers that allow it to continue to pay all its bills on time. But those maneuvers work only for a third limited time. Independent groups like the Bipartisan Policy Center in Washington and the Congressional Budget Office have estimated that sometime this summer or early this fall, the U.S. government will no longer be able to pay everyone, including bondholders, Social Security recipients, and federal employees on time. The Moody's team estimates that deadline, known as the X date, will fall on August 15th.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Creating a world where untold stories are told and unheard voices are heard. The annual IRIB World Service News Awards, dubbed SOAP Media Festival, this year had a lot to celebrate.
It's been a few years that the dynamics are changing and the new world order is emerging. The unipolar world is now turning into a multipolar world. Iran is in a position where it can speed up this process and offer a third viewpoint different from the two narratives that have always existed.
Words that clarify the mission of IRIB World Service. And this is exactly why the Arabic news channel Al Olam swept the IRIB World Service News Awards, taking home wins in nearly every major category, with its sister channel Al Olam Syria TV maintaining front-runner status with its popular talk show Zoom Room.
We are proud to be able to gain a strong foothold in Syria and West Asia in particular by shedding light on the truth and covering stories that are untold about people who have been misrepresented.
I've been with Al Alam for more than 8 years now. I have hosted many TV programs. It's great to be part of a team where the goal is to bring truth to light.
Meanwhile, the Spanish-language news channel Hispan TV, as well as Press TV, were seen as the gold standard of achievement in the television community, winning awards in different sections, including the Best Documentary and the Best News Website. Not to mention that Press TV's Palestine Declassified won the Best Political TV Show.
This is the moment we're in. We're in the end, the dying throes of US hegemony. And as he was saying, I very much agree with, the cultural infrastructure for the ending of hegemony has to be put in place, and that involves media, including news and journalism, which can give a different view on how the world is operating and tell more of the truth about the world. So, you know, the media play a central, important role in all that.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, who has covered the most difficult news stories, including the Rohingya crisis and the developments in Ukraine over the past year, was not left out.
I think two of my heroes, Noam Chomsky and John Pilger, said that they've never seen as much propaganda in the war in Ukraine than in any war that they've reported on or written about, and they've reported right back from Vietnam. So that's telling you a lot, and there's a huge amount of propaganda on Ukraine. Indeed, Ukraine is it's a civil war, but it's also a proxy war between Russia and NATO. And I think we're seeing the beginning of this split between the West and the East, China, Russia, Iran. And we're seeing a challenge to American hegemony and indeed the creation of this new multipolar world.
And according to the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB World Service is at the forefront of this propaganda war.
In this unequal war, where IRIB World Service has none of the advantages of mainstream media, from state-of-the-art technology to political support, it has been able to blaze a new trail. The fact that its news channels are frequently banned on different social media platforms is testimony to that. Meanwhile, this also proves in practice that the free flow of information and free speech are nothing more than slogans that are used as political tools by advocates of democracy.
Media play a key role in today's world. They can set the tone for diplomatic endeavors, and they are a tool of international communication. Particularly for the Islamic Republic of Iran, its media outlet can pave the way for diplomacy.
That is why there are great expectations, which means that so far, IRIB World Service has been able to deliver on its responsibilities.
In a world where mainstream media is setting the narrative, IRIB World Service has been able to break the monopoly and offer a new perspective. Gisu Mishahmadi, Tehran.
South Koreans opposed to upcoming joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises took their message to the presidential office. They worry the largest such drills in almost 5 years could lead to direct conflict.
Where did all the efforts for dialogue for each other go? We must stop the terrible threat that will actually lead to the devastation of nuclear war. We have to stop the battle without an exit. That's why we're here.
Last year, North Korea test-launched a record number of ballistic missiles, with the U.S. and South Korea routinely conducting their own missile tests and smaller military drills.
The large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises had been suspended under previous President Moon Jae-in. But that's not the policy of current President Yoon Suk-yeol, who seeks to strengthen the alliance with the United States with the frequent deployment of U.S. nuclear-capable forces.
The drills are set to include both computer-simulated war games and field exercises. North Korea views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion.
Currently, the South Korea-U.S. joint military exercise is going ahead, generating aggressive tension, and includes a preemptive strike scenario. Wherever there is such a military exercise, tensions on the Korean Peninsula increase.
More large-scale drills with the U.S. are planned for this year, as President Yoon seeks to celebrate the 70th anniversary of South Korea's alliance with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A ribbon-cutting ceremony to go down in history, opening the production line of Iran's first homegrown jet trainer, Yasin. According to Iran's Defense Minister Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, the jet trainer is capable of carrying out combat missions as well as other tactical aerial warfare actions such as close air support or CAS. Air-to-ground actions against hostile targets in close proximity of friendly forces.
Training good pilots is a